This is KZSU, Stanford. Welcome to Entitled Opinions. My name is Robert Harrison, and we're coming to you from the Stanford campus. Our topic today is immense, the figure of Ulysses across the ages. He's one of the great archetypes of the Western unconscious, he haunts the modern imagination, and he's quintessentially Greek. Along with Freud, Jung, and George Steiner, I believe that the Greeks gave names and form to almost all the major archetypes. Prometheus, Orpheus, Oedipus, Narcissus, Medea, Antigone, Cassandra, to mention a few of them. The main criterion for archetypes is reiteration, and no story in the Western tradition has reiterated more often or in more versions than the story of Ulysses. I should use the plural here because there are as many stories within Homer's Odyssey as there are archetypes. The Sirens, the Descent into Hades, Homecoming, Penelope, the Cyclops, Scylla, and Charybdis, Circe, Calypso, all are seared into our psyche and all populate an epic that revolves around the figure of Ulysses, whose name in Greek is Odysseus. To get us underway, here's a quote from a letter that James Joyce wrote in 1917. "The most beautiful, all-embracing theme is that of the Odyssey. It is greater than that of Hamlet, Don Quixote, Dante, Faust. The subject of Ulysses is the most human in world literature. Ulysses didn't want to go off to Troy. He knew that the official reason for the war, the dissemination of the culture of Hellas, was only a pretext for Greek merchants who were seeking new markets. When the recruiting officers arrived, he happened to be plowing. He pretended to be mad. Thereupon they placed his little 2-year-old son in the furrow. Observe the beauty of the motifs, the only man in Greece who is against the war, and the father. Then there's the motif of wandering. Scylla and Charybdis, what a splendid parable. Ulysses is also a great musician. He wishes to and must listen. He has himself tied to the mast. The motif of the artist, who will lay down his life rather than renounce his interest. And don't forget the trait of generosity at the interview with Ajax in the netherworld, and many other beautiful touches. I am almost afraid to treat such a theme. It's overwhelming." This from the author who went on to write a sprawling novel called Ulysses. We'll return to Joyce's idealizing portrait of the Greek trickster later in our show, but first let me introduce my guest Miles Osgood, who joined me once before on Entitled Opinions for a show about Virginia Woolf's novel To the Lighthouse. Miles Osgood has been teaching courses on Ulysses and modern literature for Stanford's English Department and Continuing Studies program. He was a longtime instructor for structural liberal education at Stanford, and he's now communications manager for the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies here at Stanford. He's written for the Washington Post, Slate, and N+1 about another ancient Greek tradition revived in modern times, the Olympic Games. Miles, welcome back to Entitled Opinions.
Thank you so much for having me back.
I mentioned that several Greek myths have had a vigorous afterlife in Western culture, with many retellings in literature, the visual arts, opera, philosophy, psychology. And Homer's Odysseus is a tremendous treasure trove of such myths. What is it about the Odyssey that gives it its archetypical staying power?
Yeah, that's a huge question, and one I've been asking every time I teach this class, and with the Odyssey kind of increasingly in the news this year with a big film coming out this summer. Why do we keep retelling it? What is it that's archetypal that is retellable? And I think I've arrived at sort of two answers. One is about the internal complexity of the character and the story itself, that it contains a lot of the other myths that you mentioned insofar as Odysseus goes to Hades and meets some of these heroes, and insofar as bards tell stories of the gods and other things. And the character himself, right, he's a captain, but also a suppliant at different times. He's a king, but also a beggar. He's a marauder, but also a victim. He's, you know, lost at sea and then back at home. We get to see him from so many different sides. Literally, the first epithet, you know, assigned to him is that he's the man of twists and turns. He's the man polutropon of many tropes, of many circles, complicated, as Emily Wilson renders it in the recent translation. So he works for us as a character that we can use in a, you know, myriad ways, according to our fancies of various different ages. And I think we'll talk about that. And, you know, to be the complex hero and anti-hero that we might want in our century as well. So that's one answer, is just what's internal to the way that Homer has rendered this character and this adventure. The other thing that I'll say, you know, and I think will come up here and there, is that he was already an archetype for Homer. That's the fun, I think, of putting Homer alongside modern adaptations, is realizing that Homer at one point in history was already doing his own modern adaptation. Odysseus goes through a world where his story is already being told back to him, and there are bards telling his story, and the sirens offered to tell his story, and he's learning how to tell his own story. And I think you get the sense that Homer is also living in a world, you know, say some 400 years after the events of the Trojan War, where this story probably had been told a number of times. And, you know, whatever we think of this figure of who Homer was, or, you know, what bards contributed to the version of the poem that we now have, they had to make interpretive choices that were appropriate for their own age, that probably modernized Odysseus for their own time. So they are already playing with an archetype that they've inherited.
So Homer is not the originator of the Odysseus story, at least not the Homer that we know as the 8th century BC.
That's how it looks to me from within the story of the Odyssey. And I think the further evidence is the example that you bring up of the things that Joyce associates with the character of Homer, the story of him plowing and Telemachus being put in the furrow. That's not in the Odyssey, right? So there's these other myths about Odysseus that are out there in ancient Greek culture. And Homer, or whoever, you know, whoever that is, is making selections and choices about how to present the hero this time around. Right. And in fact, you know, in the proem to the Odyssey, in the opening lines, you know, there's different ways of translating this, but the proem has this moment where Homer is asking the muse to, you know, to speak through him, and asks to tell the tale once more in our time. So the tale's been told, but we're going to tell it again this particular night for this particular crowd in this particular time. Yeah. And that's very telling.
Yeah. So this is a question almost parenthetical and self-referential. Is it possible to love the Odyssey without liking the character of Odysseus? And I ask that because at first he's very seductive, but the more one reads that story, the more of suspicious he is as a, first thing, as a leader.
Yeah.
He takes off from Ithaca with all the youth and he comes back empty-handed.
Yeah.
He leads his men into disaster time and again, sometimes completely unnecessarily.
Yeah.
He falls asleep at the very moment when he's going to reach Ithaca and he has to start all over because the wind blows him off. And then he returns with none of his men. So, I mean, if you put him on trial, I mean, I have put him on trial when I teach the Odyssey, when I used to teach the Odyssey, and I always found him guilty. Nevertheless, the story of the Odyssey as a whole transcends just the character of Ulysses. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. And it's funny you mentioned the trial. There's, you know, one of the adaptations that I teach is Margaret Atwood's Penelopiad, and she puts him on trial as well at the end of that novel. And I think you would expect that, right, from a 20th, 21st century feminist writer, and for him to be found guilty in that particular text. But I think what's important for us is that we can read it into Homer too. And so you ask, can you enjoy the Odyssey and have your doubts about Odysseus? And I actually think it's imperative that you do. If you want to take Homer seriously as a writer of kind of mature complexity and not as a teller of a fairy tale. And most of us encounter the figure of Odysseus in this story in childhood when he is probably a little bit sanitized and heroicized, but that's not actually how he totally appears in this epic. You mentioned, you know, specifically what it must have looked like for the Ithacans for him to sail off with the best of the young men and then to come back come back not only without them, but then to slaughter the new generation when he returns. And in fact, that is a speech that is levied against him within the Odyssey, that one of the fathers of the suitors says, "My friends, it is truly monstrous what this man has done to our city." And, you know, of course, that's going to be another villain for Odysseus to take on. That's going to be a man who's killed in the ensuing civil war. But I think it is disquieting, and deliberately so. I think of a moment to a classicist that I taught with in SLE. Kate Kretler put me onto this episode in book 8, when he's hearing his own story told back to him of what he was like during the Trojan War and how he was like the war god, you know, slaughtering the Trojans. And he's described in a very strange simile as crying like a woman over the corpse of her husband while soldiers are at her back, prodding her back and forcing her into slavery. And initially you think, oh, wow, how lyrical and beautiful and tragic and complex that Odysseus is crying like this woman, how kind of unmasculine, in fact, of a comparison. And yet the deeper you go into the simile, and Homer's similes extend and extend, they are epic, as we call them, you realize that in that scene, he's the soldier holding the spear as much as he is the woman crying in this particular moment. So he may well be interrupting the story deliberately. Homer is making sure that we see what the bard in the moment is not going to show us, the playing out of that scene and where Odysseus actually was in that scene. And I think if we want to take Homer seriously, we can't just say, oh, his times were different. You know, Odysseus was a hero. We have to think, no, the Greeks had lived through so much through the Trojan War and the centuries afterward that he must have seen Odysseus for who he really was in full.
Yeah. I can't help but be influenced by Virgil and to some extent Dante, where on the side of the Trojans, every time I would read the Iliad, I would just always wanted the Trojans to win the war. There was nothing you could do to make that happen. But of course, he's the great villain for the Trojans because he's the ideator of the Trojan horse, treachery, trickery. Yeah. Cunning, all these things that bring about the downfall of, and Virgil calls him Dirus and Scelleratum. He's dire, he's dreadful, and he is wicked, you know, wicked in his nature. Anyway, putting that aside, I think you're right to say that the Odyssey has all the more appeal insofar as it's not idealizing.
Yeah.
The way James Joyce's interpretation of the Odyssey seems very idealizing to me and seems to leave out all the darker side of the character of Ulysses, just calls him the most human and the most, anyway, we'll get to James Joyce shortly. I mentioned a few of the archetypical motifs, if you want to call them, in the larger story, when you have these sea women, a bunch of sea women, Circe and Calypso, but also the story of the sirens and the descent into the underworld.
Yeah.
It's not really a descent, it's a visit.
To the outer reaches of the world. Yeah.
Outer reaches, yes. So we don't have time to go through them all because we want to get to the adaptations.
Sure.
But maybe we could touch briefly on the episode of the sirens and perhaps the descent into Hades, because that Katabasis is hugely important. And it sets the paradigm for a bunch of subsequent epic descents into the realm of the dead.
Yeah, absolutely.
But maybe the sirens first. What do you think?
No, yeah, I agree. So the sirens is a really important episode because one thing that's going to happen over the course of the millennia of rewriting the Odyssey is authors questioning how much Odysseus really desired to go home versus appreciated the wonders of the journey.
Right.
And, you know, that is to some extent a modern or medieval, as the case may be, kind of imposition backward insofar as Homer is pretty clear about telling us that most of the journey is suffering and most of the journey is unwilled and unwanted. Nevertheless, the Sirens episode stands out in that respect because Circe tells Odysseus, you know, if you want to, kind of gives him the option, you know, if you want to experience the song of the sirens while still remaining safe, there is a trick you can pull to be able to have that experience on what is otherwise a very treacherous adventure of suffering. And he chooses it, right? He says, yes, tie me to the mast, leave my ears open so I can hear the song, I will plug the ears of my crewmates with wax and tell them to leave me bound so that I can hear the song of the sirens without being driven to have us row the boat into the rocks and have us all die. So in and of itself, the Homeric scene is really interesting because what the sirens offer to Odysseus, in fact, doesn't seem like it should be so seductive. They are offering him his story back to him. So they say, we know all you have suffered. We know everything that happened in Troy. We know how great you are, Odysseus. Maybe that is the ultimate seduction, especially for Odysseus, is hearing his own glory praised. But the one part of it that maybe we can understand, and I think this speaks to what we were just saying about Homer, is they are offering an omniscience that Odysseus doesn't have as a storyteller. They know everything. The sirens say, we know everything that happened to the Greeks and the Trojans. So they are able to tell, I think, the story of the Iliad the way that Homer tells the story of the Iliad, exactly the way that you were just saying, where we might have a kind of sympathy for Hector and his family as a foil to Odysseus and the Ithacan family, because the sirens are able to see it all. And that is sufficiently suggestive to Odysseus that he is drawn to the melodious song and wants to be unbound and, you know, wants to go to them no matter the cost. And that's quite significant.
And subsequently, the sirens, when they're incorporated into other reiterations, it changes a little bit, no? It becomes, when Dante, for example, the sirens is just the deception of a false semblance of beauty and seduction, but that the reality is it's an old hag who is, delusion. I don't think delusion is part of the it's significant element in the original telling. But what do you make of has this had such a so powerful hold?
At their origin, the sirens are bird women who are also associated with sometimes snatching the shades that are on their way to Hades. And they are a danger in that respect. They're, I think, taken later to be either deceptive as hags or to be so beautiful as women that they're seductive. But that doesn't seem to be there in the original text. I'll give a few examples of what happens to the sirens in the 20th century so you can think about ways in which they might be laden with other meanings. So for Kafka, in his story, The Silence of the Sirens, this is a battle between human ingenuity and divine power, that the sirens represent a kind of divine omniscience, where the scariest thing about them ultimately is not their song, but what they could also choose to do, which is to be silent about you as you pass, to have a god who's capable of seeing the world and knowing the world, have nothing to say to you, would in fact be more shattering. Now, the problem is that in the Kafka version, Odysseus has a ruse where he has actually, in fact, decided to defy them and gum up his ears, if I'm remembering correctly. And so there's this interplay in this absurdist vein of sort of like, who will destroy whom? Will the mortal who is willing to resist the gods make the gods vanish in our time because they are so in awe of him and his ability to resist them, to even resist their silence? It's a very paradoxical, squirrely story, as you might expect from Kafka. Then there's a more fanciful Marxist reading by Theodor Adorno and Max Horkheimer in The Dialectic of Enlightenment, where they're really interested in Odysseus having chained his crew to the mast and having him row past something that he can experience, a musical piece that will not change his course. And they say, oh, how bourgeois of Odysseus to want to hear the concert, but not want to change his life as a result, right? Just to have this brief entertainment that could utterly transform him while his working class goes on doing the labor for him, but nevertheless to restrain himself, like the good middle-class Protestant ethic hero that he is, and not let it transform him. And then finally, we have Joyce. And for Joyce, it's Odysseus's admiration of musical craft and learning from the sirens how for himself to become a storyteller. Mm-hmm. He says, oh, the sirens have this really seductive, destructive song that they tell about the world and about the war. If I could learn that, I could play that to my advantage too. Or if I could learn that beauty, I could be glorious as they are. And in fact, I think we talked about this when we were talking together about all of these texts a few months ago. Odysseus does that to the Phaeacians. He tells them a seductive song about himself, and it ends in near disaster or suspenseful disaster for them as Poseidon takes out his revenge against the Phaeacians when Odysseus leaves.
Right. Well, we never know what is the case and what's not the case, whether that story that he presumably learns and then reiterates in the court of the Phaeacians is actually true or not, whether it's just a way of seducing them
right
with a siren song of his own, because he is a siren.
Yeah. And one indication we have is he tells other versions of his Odyssey to other people later in the, including the swineherd and Penelope, where he continues to change the details of the Odyssey that we know or the Odyssey that we take to be the truth. And it really unsettles our sense of what is real.
Yeah. And also when he's listening, he's not enraptured aesthetically. He seems to be experiencing enormous pain at what he's listening to, no?
It depends on the translation. So, you know, we'll have to ask Richard Martin and our classicist friends about this. Emily Wilson, I think, renders it as the song was so melodious that it does draw him in. And so Joyce would like that reading. Yeah. But I think, yeah, he certainly struggles against the binding that he has set himself in his desire to know what the rest of the song would be.
Yeah, so the Adorno reading would be typically reductive for... from my point of view, which it doesn't surprise me that he would want Ulysses unbound. No,
right.
To break the bonds of the bourgeoisie.
And this becomes their paradigm for reading Odysseus altogether, right? He's the guy who restrains himself at every turn from the kinds of primeval, mythical pleasures he could have so as to be a hero of the Enlightenment instead.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely ridiculous interpretation from my point of view, because if there's anyone who doesn't restrain himself for his 10 years trying to get back home with the... Calypso and Circe and wanting to go to the dead. I mean, he puts no restraint on his curiosity whatsoever. And that's what makes him a kind of hero for the modern imagination, which exalts adventure, discovery, innovation, the new world, and so forth. It's also what makes him a villain of sorts for Dante. Dante's fascinated by Ulysses, but when he gives a portrait of him in Inferno 26, it's his bad curiosity, the mala curiositas of a character who simply cannot restrain himself. Whenever he reaches a limit, he's compelled to transgress it. Hmm. So he gets to the Straits of Gibraltar, the Pillars of Hercules, which warn seafarers not to venture into this other territory. It's a forbidden territory. So he said, no, let's go. He convinces his men, leads them to disaster. So it's really the opposite of the restraint that you have in the Adorno interpretation. Anyway, I'll leave that.
No, it's great. And the thing, you know, about Dante, you know, that connects to what we've been describing as the kind of standout adventures of Odysseus is that his misadventure involves going past the Strait of Gibraltar and into the Atlantic. And it seems as though we are rethinking his journey to Hades in the underworld, which is also described as being at the river ocean at kind of the end of the world. And in that adventure to Hades in the Odyssey and in Homer, he gets this prophecy from Tiresias that he will have to go on a second adventure, go inland, as the case happens to be, to ultimately placate Poseidon until he meets another traveler who doesn't recognize his oar and thinks it's that it's a winnowing fan. And so Dante, without even having access to Homer, is somehow magically able to pick up that idea that there's a second trip for Odysseus and a trip that involves Hades, that involves this prophecy, that involves the ends of the world. And I think that's one of the things that we see play out is a version of a character that is suggested in Homer in the Sirens episode, in this Tiresias prophecy, of somebody who does desire the exploration and does and perhaps wants a second odyssey even after he makes it back to Ithaca.
Yeah. I did a monologue on Ulysses a couple of years ago, I think, and... Dante doesn't see him only as venturing into the realm of the dead, but also venturing into a historical era that he was ahead of his time, which is purgatory. He reaches the mountain of purgatory, essentially, before a storm from the land sinks the ship. And he's there really before Dante. Mm-hmm. Yet the outcome is tragic rather than comic, for Dante is comic because it's divinely sanctioned.
Yeah.
For Ulysses, it's not divinely sanctioned, but he clearly is looking. It's never stated explicitly, but you know, in the kind of shadows of the narrative in Dante, you have a sense that Ulysses is really seeking Christian salvation or some kind of way not to die.
Yeah,
which is not the Elysian fields, but to explore this other possibility. Anyway, Dante himself is the successful Ulysses. So there again, even in an epic which has a dim view of Ulysses. Ulysses is almost like the alter ego of Dante himself. So,
does that mean Dante has an admiration for Ulysses at some level, or for the shape of Ulysses' adventure, in spite of the fact that it's pointed in the wrong way? Or is that what it is?
Oh, yeah. Dante knew that he was undertaking a journey that no one had undertaken before. You know, it's a Star Trek thing, going where no one has gone before. And he... for some reason, he gives us a portrait of Ulysses as that the one person who was there before almost made it. I mean, he made it, but...
he didn't know what purgatory was. He didn't know what mountain he was crashing.
He seemed to have some kind of inkling or intuition that there was something better than the Elysian fields of limbo in Inferno 4.
Yeah, yeah.
Where we live with desire without hope. Yeah. We live in desire without hope. He doesn't want to live in desire without hope. Mm-hmm. He wants to see if he can actually barge into this Christian era, which mm-hmm. is two or three centuries before the Christ event has occurred. So it's that heroic, adventurous, transgressive Ulysses
yeah.
that is, on the one hand, under indictment in Dante,
yeah.
but on the other hand, is a figure of fascination.
Totally.
And of course, it's the Ulysses who's under indictment who inherits the modern era insofar as he is an anachronistic figure mm-hmm. who is a figure of all the explorers who yeah. discovered the new world in the age of exploration. He's a figure of a scientific revolution. And, you know, he tells his men, think of your sowing. We were not meant to live like brutes, but to follow virtue and knowledge. Yeah. So these ideals of continuous exploration. And then we have the famous poem by Lord Alfred Tennyson, where he is indeed the one who to strive, to seek, to think, and not to yield, whatever. Yeah. He's a figure of the heroic defiance of limits
yeah.
that a lot of the modern era seems to be about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm glad that we got Dante in there a little bit, because we're going to concentrate mostly on the 20th century retellings. And when it comes to the 20th century, I can't help but think that the journey to Hades is also hugely important
yeah.
because so much of the epic tradition is about visiting the dead. And Ezra Pound's Cantos begins with a rewriting of Book 11 mm-hmm. of the Odyssey, and then went down to the ship, set keel to breakers, yeah. forth on the godly sea.
Yeah,
Joyce does it. There's, after the First World War especially, one mm-hmm. has a sense that someone has to give voice to a whole generation that, you know, that perished in that war. So how important do you think the journey to Hades is in the adaptations to come?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think the fact that Odysseus has to go to the ends of the world and create a blood sacrifice to have the shades of the past come up and talk to him and to be able to see the heroes that preceded him does seem like an appropriate image, of course, for Pound, who's going to conjure voices from all over the past, from all these libraries and manuscripts that he's going to work into the cantos. But really for every 20th century writer who's invested in what T.S. Eliot ultimately calls a mythical method of trying to use the literature of the ancient past to help make sense of the present and the future. Ultimately, that's what Odysseus is trying to do, right? Is he wants to know how he can survive his journey, how he can atone with the gods that hate him in his journey back to Ithaca, how he can find peace going forward. And that's such a problem for the 20th century, is how we can get past a cataclysmic world war like the Trojan War, you know, deal with the cycle of violence that follows from that, and ultimately commit the right acts of penance and sacrifice and travel and journey and understanding, which includes penance with the past, so as to be able to find peace and go forward. And I think that spans modern Odyssean adaptations from Joyce to Derek Walcott. You know, Hades is just one chapter in Ulysses. It's Leopold Bloom going to a funeral at a cemetery and having his typical Bloomian thoughts. We'll get into who that is and what this novel is about, corpses and the dead and whatnot. But Hades becomes almost the entire project of meditation by the 90s for Derek Walcott.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about some of these main authors that we decided that we would focus on. Yeah. James Joyce, Derek Walcott, and Louise Glück. So the floor is yours.
Okay.
We start with Joyce.
Yeah. So Joyce really broke the doors open for how to make use of the Odyssey in the 20th century. Like I say, between Dante and Tennyson and Keats and all sorts of other folks, Odysseus never left Western literature. We have always been adapting Homer's epics. But when Joyce found a way of writing about his own home city of Dublin, a single day in Dublin in Ulysses, T.S. Eliot credited him with having come up with a schema for making the chaos and disorder of modern life manageable and organizable by way of an ancient literary archetype. So what Joyce did is he divided up, you know, 18 hours or more, in fact, of this day in Dublin, June 16th, 1904, according to the episodes of the Odyssey, and assigned characters as correspondences to characters in the Odyssey. So his own alter ego, Stephen Dedalus, from A Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, comes back as Telemachus. He's no longer now the Dedalus figure. He's kind of been remythologized as Telemachus, also perhaps as Hamlet and as Icarus. You know, Joyce is happy to overlay his myths. There is a new character introduced into the city of Dublin from Joyce's literary universe, who is Leopold Bloom, of Hungarian Jewish extraction, who is a bit of a loner in Dublin by nature of his racial and religious identification, who wanders around the city by choice for a whole day because he knows that his wife, Molly, has an appointment with a singing program leader, Blazes Boylan, who and is going to have an affair with him. And Bloom is going to let this affair happen, essentially. He's not going to intervene. So in terms of what the Odyssey is doing in this kind of structure, there is the Eliot argument of just giving shape to Joyce's desire to write about modernity, write about Dublin, write about, you know, a poet and an ad canvasser and the unlikely father-son relationship they might have as a Telemachus and Odysseus of our time. The other thing that it sort of provides for us, I've always thought, is in a novel that is about ordinariness and everyday life and the random free associations that occur in our consciousness, all the things that Joyce is famous for, it at least gives us a bit of a suspense mechanism that there is a story we want to see play out once we recognize that the Odyssey is at play. Joyce didn't immediately give the title names for all the 18 episodes of the Odyssey. He kind of leaked that out via schemas to critics and friends so that we would know that there's all these 18 Odyssean episodes, but there is the title Ulysses. So I think we are able to pick up on the fact that there is an Odyssean story playing out here. And so we have to ask ourselves, okay, Stephen and Bloom are not related. What is going to be the nature of their father-son relationship? What is going to be the nature of their reunion, as it were? Molly is going to have this affair. She's going to be a disloyal Penelope. How is Bloom going to react to that? Is there going to be bloodshed? Is there going to be any kind of confrontation between him and Boylan the way that there is between Odysseus and the suitors? And yeah, in a 20th century world where experiences of exile and migration are increasingly common and increasingly part of the literary world, I suppose they were never not part of the literary world. What will Joyce have to say about the experience of being an ethnic outsider in his own home territory of Dublin? What does that do for him in terms of establishing an Irish literary national identity at the turn of Irish independence? There are all of these threads that come in one way or another from themes of the Odyssey, family themes, themes of exile, themes of fidelity and infidelity that give what would otherwise be just a day in the life of Dublin a story, and a story with suspense.
Yeah. How carefully does Joyce actually trace his source in these episodes?
It's pretty loose. Yeah. There are all kinds of ways. You know, when I teach this, I give my students Joyce's schema for Ulysses, where he's not only using the Odyssey, but he's also using the organs of the body and different intellectual disciplines. There's all kinds of different ways you could consider this novel to be organized that are not just based on the Odyssey. And I will blank out the Odyssean correspondences and have students guess, and students come up with different kinds of associations. So for instance, you know, in the Calypso episode, which is the episode where we meet Leopold and Molly Bloom, I think often our first guess is that, oh, you know, the woman in bed must be Calypso. And yet, you know, Joyce tells us, no, there's a painting of a nymph that Bloom has cut out of a magazine that's hanging on the wall, and that's Calypso. So there's these funny ways in which he sets up this paradigm of a schema and all these correspondences, and I think also has fun with his readers, yeah, in terms of subverting those expectations too. I think the mistake that we make with Joyce sometimes is assuming that the superstructure, as Eliot thought, really is the key to reading the book. In fact, that only really gets us so far. To me, the better moments are where we see Joyce actually having fun with small details in Homer, where you can tell that he actually knows the poem quite well, probably from his Jesuit schooling, or remembers certain details of it quite well, where he really then is able to do creative adaptations that to me are more important and more significant than what he's doing in terms of the arc of the story. I think of specifically, you know, Joyce having a theory of epiphany that comes out of a kind of Greek notion of divine manifestation, also by way, of course, of the Catholic epiphany of the apparition of Jesus to the Magi. I think of a really important scene to me where Bloom takes a bath. Baths are so important in Homer in terms of the revelation of heroes and the revelation of their identity. And I think of even little funny things like where Joyce does versions of the Homeric catalogs when he comes up with inane, silly lists of things in the Cyclops episode.
So can you clarify something you said a minute ago about exile and immigration? Why did he choose to make his Ulysses figure someone of Hungarian Jewish extraction who is not, I mean, Odysseus is clearly Greek. He's a king. He's the king of Ithaca. He doesn't have any sort of ambiguity about his belonging and rootedness in his native land.
Yeah. There's a few different ways of answering that question. So there, you know, there are biographical details of how Joyce came up with the story of Ulysses and came up with the story of how Stephen and Bloom would ultimately unite that have to do with his own experience of having been knocked out in a fight in Dublin and having been rescued by a local Jewish man who took some kindness on him. There's the fact that Joyce associated with Jews in Central Europe, including Italo Svevo, when he was writing this book and moving around. And I think that's, you know, another important part of that is Joyce was himself a nomad living in exile, running away from war throughout the 1910s as he was writing this. As you say, in Trieste, in Zurich, in Paris, and felt like him probably himself an outsider in those ways and started to look back at his home city for its outsiders rather than its Irishmen. And I think all of this also allows him to try to create a pluralist, modernist view of his home city and his home country at a time when the nationalists are taking control, right? That's very important. We see that in the Cyclops episode where Bloom's Jewishness is the biggest problem for him, is the biggest threat to his safety when the Irish nationalist, simply known as the citizen, is the Cyclops who's going to potentially brain him in the bar. And Joyce is, as we see from his description of Odysseus the draft dodger, is living out World War I and committing himself to being a pacifist and a pluralist and wants his Odysseus to be like that. And as we've said, Odysseus is not really like that, but that's one of the transformations he's going to impose. And so to have Irish home rule as a movement relate to the Jewish search for a home, to Zionism in this particular era, also to, you know, Greek notions of a kind of Achaean alliance of different identities and different cultures and different peoples, including the backwater of Ithaca, allows Joyce to estrange what it means to be Irish as its own kind of backwater island in part of an empire.
Great. Excellent. Thank you. One last question about Joyce, and then we need to move on maybe.
Yeah.
But the figure of Molly, and as you said, she's the anti-Penelope in some ways. What do you make of her and her role within the superstructure of the Odyssey?
Yeah. So when we meet Molly first, we wonder, you know, is she a Calypso figure? Ultimately, she is the Penelope. She gives the final monologue in 8 interminable sentences at the end of the novel. She is very unlike the archetype of Penelope. And this is going to be a thing we come back to with Louise Glück too, insofar as she is not the weeping, cloistered, patient, loyal, attic-dwelling queen of Ithaca that we have in Odysseus, in the Odyssey, who is a richly described character, but something very different, but rather the fully embodied, dirty-mouthed, dirty-appetited woman who's having an affair on this particular day and thinking about the various lovers she's had in the past and comparing them in different ways and worried about getting pregnant and thinking about her period coming on and all of these things that Joyce is using to, you know, shock the literary establishment of the time, but also to render, I think, psychological womanhood and physiological womanhood in a way that a lot of writers, certainly male writers, but writers in general, had not been able to do or not been willing to do, to the point that some feminist critics really claim Joyce's Penelope as a supreme example of feminine writing, of women's writing, as Hélène Cixous says, or feminist writing. Mm. And I take that argument. I think there is something so startlingly open about how he writes that character, partly from his own relationship with his wife, Nora Barnacle, that really breaks open the doors and the windows from, you know, how femininity had been written through the 19th century.
Great. So, Maz, we move on now to Derek Walcott, and we can't assume that all of our listeners know much about Derek Walcott, if anything at all. So, who was Derek Walcott, and how did he rewrite the story?
Yeah, Derek Walcott is a Black but mixed race poet from St. Lucia, an island in the Caribbean, who ultimately won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1992, and I think did it on the strength of having published Omeros 2 years before. I mean, he wrote many beautiful collections of poems.
Really, Omeros being the name for Homer.
Yes, Omeros being the Greek name for Homer. That's really his masterpiece. He was reluctant to call it an epic, and I think it has lyric and historical elements in addition to being a kind of comedy, a kind of Dantean comedy written in triplets, or I should say tercets. But it is also an epic in addition to all of those things, and one that is specifically written so as to map the Aegean onto the Caribbean in the way that I think Joyce wanted to map Ithaca onto Ithaca and all of the Mediterranean onto Dublin and the Irish Sea. So in Walcott's Omeros, we start out more in an Iliad register. There's a Hector and an Achille. There's Philoctet, another hero of the Trojan War, who is marooned. But in the middle of the story, we have two Odyssean adventures. The Achilles character, Achille, a poor Black fisherman who's cut off from his ancestry, has a sort of sunstroke fantasy dream where he travels across the Atlantic to try to meet his forebears in Africa, and in fact tried to change the course of history himself. He, like Achilles, he goes and fights a war, in this case to try to liberate men who will one day become slaves, traveling back hundreds of years. And then a thorn vine loops his ankle, like Achilles being shot in his one weak point in the Greek mythical world. And ultimately, he returns back to St. Lucia and has to think about, you know, how he will live going forward. And then there's the poet, Derek Walcott, who goes on his own adventure to North America and to Europe to think about the history of the slave trade, the history of racial genocide in America, but especially, I think for him, a literary history that goes all the way back to the Odyssey, all the different places in Europe where he can find kind of archaeological or living evidence of Homer being around, that he finds Homer in Ireland, and insofar as he goes back, he goes on pilgrimage to find the land of Joyce. He finds Homer in London, insofar as he thinks of this as the place that translated perhaps Homer for him. And he ultimately goes all the way out to Greece, where he has his own vision of Odysseus meeting the sirens and at the mast.
That's great. Well, I don't want to rush us too much, but we do want to say a word about Louise Glück before we get to the end of our time. Yeah. So I want to invite, whoever's interested to actually go and read Omeros.
Oh, it's an incredible poem.
Yeah, it is.
And as deeply referential and difficult as something like Ulysses, but also as beautiful and as compelling on the level of the sentence. And if you are a fan of the Odyssey or anything Odyssean or anything Greek, that can be your way in. If you are interested in post-colonial history and literature, that can be your way in. If you are interested in a lyric expression of what it means to try to find your way, as Walcott would put it, as a new world poet who wants to ultimately abandon a culture of references, that can be your way in.
Great. So Louise Glück also, again, we might want to just say a word about her biographically, introduce her to the audience before we talk about the way she has appropriated and reappropriated the Odyssey myths.
Yeah. So Louise Glück writes this book of poetry called Meadowlands, which she publishes in 1996. So pretty close to Omeros, but a very different project, a lyric project, where she runs in parallel poems about the Odyssey, but especially about Penelope and Odysseus and their son Telemachus, who intervenes quite a bit, with the story of the dissolution of her own marriage and maybe also some reflections about her own son from a previous marriage. And in general, the poems kind of move back and forth between Odyssey poems and poems about her own life in New Jersey. In both, she is worried about the problem of fidelity and infidelity. She imagines a Penelope which is not especially faithful representation of the faithful Penelope in Odysseus. In the Odyssey, this is a Penelope with appetites and a Penelope with kind of her own secrets while she imagines what Odysseus has been up to all of these years. And you can sense that this is coming from a woman writing her own lyric who is also frustrated at having been cheated upon and having her marriage fall apart as a result, and wants to have her own desires acknowledged and expressed throughout this poetry. And yet, you know, I think the easy correspondence between Penelope and Louise, you know, Penelope and Glick, and Odysseus and John, her husband, works throughout most of the collection, but that's not all there is to it. There's at least one poem where she actually does bring the two pieces together. It's called Heart's Desire, where she employs in kind of sonnet form her own, as it were, almost epic simile. And I, you know, I think we're wrapping up, so I won't read all of it.
Oh, go ahead.
But okay, I'll do it quickly. So the poem goes, I've got the name wrong. It's Quiet Evening. I was thinking of a different poem. Okay. You take my hand and then we're alone in the life-threatening forest. Almost immediately, we're in a house. Noah's grown and moved away. The clematis after 10 years suddenly flowers white. More than anything in the world, I love these evenings when we're together. The quiet evenings in summer, the sky still light at this hour. So Penelope took the hand of Odysseus, not to hold him back, but to impress this piece on his memory. From this point on, the silence through which you move is my voice pursuing you. And it's an extended simile, or perhaps a sonnet with a volta, you know, however you want to think about it. But the initial long comparison between, you know, Penelope, Louise, Odysseus, and John kind of doesn't work by the time you get to the final lines. The silence through which you move is my voice pursuing you seems to suggest that there is another way in which this poet also identifies with Odysseus and is invested in this project because she wants to have the adventures and the appetites and the exploratory curiosity of the hero of the poem, of Odysseus, and not just of Penelope. And I think once you see that and you read the rest of the collection, it really opens it up. And I think it maybe opens up these other modern retellings too, that there are the kinds of correspondences that somebody like Joyce will give you in the schema, but you need not limit yourself to those. The links between characters and their writers or characters modern and ancient can crisscross in ways that you don't initially expect.
So if readers get their hands on Meadowlands, and also, there are other collections of hers which use the mythical method, as T.S. Eliot mm-hmm. calls it, in mm-hmm. Achilles and so forth.
Yeah, she's an Achilles. She has a she has a Dante collection, the Vita Nuova collection.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you would, because they are individual lyrics, mm-hmm. but I don't think it has a narrative structure that unfolds from poem to poem, or does it?
I would actually say it maybe is able to do both. The lyrics can certainly be read on their own, but I do sense a bit of a story here, a lyrical story, which is one of sort of self-creation and self-affirmation of somebody who sees in Penelope a woman who might have had her own desires and ambitions thwarted by nature of what it was like to be confined to Ithaca for all those years, but who can also therefore be a model for something different, for a poet writing in the 20th century who wants to see her own life as partly Penelopean, but partly Odyssean as well.
Exactly. Great. I'm going to leave us with two things. One is our exit song, mm-hmm. which I chose Suzanne Vega, her song Calypso, so that
great
you know that beforehand. But I thought that I would read Ithaca. It's a poem by Constantine Cavafy, a Greek from Alexandria, late 19th, early 20th century, one of the great modern poets. And he has a quite well-known moving poem called Ithaca. So it's just one more iteration of how the story of the Odyssey has this archetypical span that is still ongoing and will certainly have future iterations. So I'll read that poem and leave our listeners with it. But let me first thank you again, Miles Osgood from the Ho Center for Buddhist Studies here at Stanford. Thanks again for coming on for the second time to Entitled Opinions. We'll get you back again in the future for some other topic, I hope.
Oh, thank you so much. This is always such fun, and I always have new ideas coming out of conversations like this.
Excellent. Thanks. So here we go with Ithaca by Constantine Cavafy. As you set out for Ithaca, hope your road is a long one, full of adventure, full of discovery. Lastrigonians, Cyclops, angry Poseidon, don't be afraid of them. You'll never find things like that on your way as long as you keep your thoughts raised high. As long as a rare excitement stirs your spirit and your body, Lestrigronians, Cyclops, and Poseidon, you won't encounter them unless you bring them along inside your soul, unless your soul sets them up in front of you. Keep Ithaca always in your mind. Arriving there is what you're destined for, but don't hurry the journey at all. Better if it lasts for years, so you're old by the time you reach the island, wealthy with all you've gained on the way, not expecting Ithaca to make you rich. Ithaca gave you the marvelous journey. Without her, you wouldn't have set out, She has nothing left to give you now. And if you find her poor, Ithaca won't have fooled you. Wise as you will have become, so full of experience, you'll have understood by then what these Ithacas mean. I'm Robert Harrison for Entitled Opinions. Thanks for listening.
My name is Calypso, and I have lived alone. I live on an island, and I wake into the dawn. A long time ago, I watched him struggle with the sea. I knew that he was drowning, and I brought him into me. Now today, thick and wild and hidden is the sweetness there that grows. My hair it blows long as I sing into the wind. I tell of nights where I could taste the salt on his skin. Salt of the waves and of tears.